Welcome to Moroccan American, a podcast about Morocco and the United States. These two countries have maintained a consistent and long-term friendship over centuries, even while their common interests have not always perfectly aligned. What started this relationship and what has sustained it? Diving into the fields of diplomacy, literature, trade, and art, in this podcast, we'll dissect different parts of the Moroccan American friendship and try to better understand this fascinating, complex, and close relationship. We're taking on an interesting historical question in this podcast episode. How did America and Americans support and shape Moroccan independence? In doing so, we're touching on an old theme of travelers, Americans who came to Morocco and Moroccans who came to the U.S. David Stenner, Associate Professor of History at Christopher Newport University, joins the podcast today to talk about U.S.-Morocco connections and cooperation during Morocco's push for independence from France and Spain in the 1950s. We'll bring in a handful of interesting, unheralded characters from both countries, and we'll draw on his terrific 2019 book, Globalizing Morocco, published by Stanford University Press. Among other things, the book and our conversation discuss how New York City can be seen as an important site in the Moroccan independence struggle. I hope you enjoy our conversation. David, can you set up the Moroccan independence movement? What made the Moroccan nationalist movement or the Moroccan movement for independence from France and Spain different than perhaps its neighbors?
So the Moroccan nationalist or at least anti-colonial movement burst on the stage in April and May 1930 through the mass protests organized against the by now infamous Berber Dahir, right? This edict by the French colonial administration trying to implement different customary law in Berber majority areas. And thereby it was perceived by many Moroccans separating them from the Arab dominated cities and their surroundings, right? So it was a mass protest. It's well known in Moroccan history. And you see, and sort of modern nationalist thought is spreading throughout Morocco, often protests against France were not necessarily driven by modern political ideology, right? The really prominent protest in the fall of 1937 in Meknès was basically local population rising up against French settlers diverting water from a local river to their own benefit, right? So often people were angry at colonialism, they're protesting local specific injustices. And then this still relatively elitist urban nationalist leadership is implementing or like imposing its ideas, its political vision onto that and forging out of that a nationalist movement. After Meknès, the nationalist movement is decapitated. Its leaders are sent into exile. Alain El Fassi, for example, is sent to Gabon, Ahmed Belafrej to Corsica. Others are interned somewhere in Morocco. And we have quote unquote quiet in Morocco. That's how the French perceived it. And this continues throughout the Second World War, at least on the surface, whereas under the surface, and that's a topic that hasn't been fully researched yet, the anti-colonial activists are reconstituting their movement as a truly mass movement. In December 43, so 1 year after the so-called liberation of Morocco from Vichy France by the American troops, the Istiklal Party is founded. It obviously, the Declaration of Independence is published in January 1944. And that's sort of the second act, or the main act of actual anti-colonial nationalism as a mass movement that keeps on growing and ultimately secures Morocco's independence. And what is really important is to also look at Spanish Morocco at the same time. The situation there was quite different.
Interesting. Okay.
Because in Spain, because of the civil war, that actually Spanish civil war breaks out in Morocco with the rebellion by the African army under Francisco Franco, takes over northern Morocco, and then conquers the Iberian Peninsula and establishes the, you know, Catholic nationalist dictatorship in 1939 over all of Spain. And the Spanish nationalists, as they called themselves, the rebels, they actually struck a deal with a small politically conscious elite of Tetuan. They allowed the Hizb al-Islah al-Watani, the Party of National Reform, to be established. And then they officially recognized it in 1936 in December. And the Hizb al-Islah basically remains operative throughout the entirety until the eve of independence. They cooperate closely with nationalists in French Morocco. So even though they had separate trajectories, they were very close intertwined. Many of these people knew each other from studying together, through family relations. And there were also, you know, repeated bursts of repression and arrests. And then usually the Spaniards used just fines to just fine the Moroccans for all kinds of, you know, what they perceived to be nasty things they had said about the Spaniards. It's a different trajectory, but it's the second arm of the nationalist movement. And of course, after independence, Hizb al-Islah and Hizb al-Istiqlal merged into one party, the Istiqlal Party. So that is the larger trajectory. And then what makes the Moroccan nationalist movement truly, not entirely unique, but what sets it apart from other anti-colonial nationalist movements around the world, across the Arab world, is the degree to which it engaged in anti-colonial advocacy on the international stage. So this already begins to a certain degree during the interwar period, where they lobby in Cairo and to a lesser degree in Paris to get sympathies and support for Morocco's claim for not yet independence, but at least radical reforms to the protectorate apparatus. Yeah. And then after 1944, they actually organized an international campaign to put public pressure on France and Spain that might ultimately lead to the end of the protectorates.
Do you have a theory or an explanation for why Morocco takes this specifically international approach? Is it merely that you had a set of leaders that are really innovative, or is there another explanation?
I think it's several factors. I think the idea, you know, to sort of, we have to also ascribe some degree of, you know, innovation and originality to the Moroccans and admit that, you know, they had a very good understanding of international politics, the international relations around colonialism. And they knew that international diplomacy had made the colonization of Morocco in 1912 through the Treaty of Fez a possibility in the first place. There had been a long diplomatic runoff before that. And so they also thought, well, if international relations sort of leads to colonialism, maybe us influencing international relations might lead to the end of colonialism. What also makes it unique is their very sophisticated way of reaching out. I mean, anti-colonial activists around the world did similar things. The Moroccans were not the first nor the last, and they were never the only ones. What set them apart was that they are very organized, they're very effective at what they're doing, to a degree I would argue that few, if any, other movement was. But at the same time, there might have also been some underlying structural factors that contributed to it. Because Morocco was on the far west of the Arab world, and because Moroccans in the Middle East, in places like Egypt, Syria, are often perceived to be not fully Arab. And sometimes, you know, even their Islam seems strange, right? If you, you know, talk to people in Egypt and many of these places. At the same time, Cairo was the center of intellectual Arab life, of Arab nationalism. So Moroccans went there to study at Cairo University, the first modern university in an Arab country. They also, of course, studied in Paris. And so by being forced to travel abroad, because there were no universities in Morocco, they were exposed to an international milieu, on the one hand in France, on the other hand in Cairo, and realized the importance of reaching out, the possibilities of creating solidarity, and thereby maybe getting help and assistance in the long run, learning about international affairs, and then in France, realizing that there was a substantial part, at least, of the French intelligentsia, though not only them, that actually was sympathetic to their demands, right? Not all Frenchmen were like the colonizers in Morocco. And realizing that they thought that, well, maybe we can reach out to these people and use, you know, create networks of solidarity that might actually benefit us, right? So ultimately, the constraints of being, quote unquote, tucked away from the rest of the Arab world and the need to join larger Arab intellectual life provides them with a perspective of a semi-outsider, which grants them insights into the politics of anti-colonialism that somebody that had grown up in, say, Cairo or Damascus might not have had to at least the same degree.
So can we bring in the American side? You know, we're interested specifically in this series and kind of United States-Morocco connections, historical connections. What are some of these connections? Well, I guess set the stage for U.S. interest in Morocco in kind of the early nationalist period, the 30s and into the 40s and even the early 50s.
So Morocco isn't central, but it is part of a larger strategy with more important goals. So from the two perspectives emerge during this period from about 46, 47 until independence in 56. Actually, we might say three, right? So first, there is the State Department, which, you know, is in charge of foreign policy. And the policymakers in the State Department, almost to a man, stand by France. For them, regional stability is the number one goal. And France is supposed to be a close partner in NATO and just, you know, in general, Western defense. And so offending France over what they think is a pretty unimportant country like Morocco seems unreasonable. Then there is the nascent intelligence and national sort of security apparatus that is being built and that, of course, by the middle of the 20th century has sort of taken over American foreign policy. And that is begins with the establishment of the CIA and the aftermath of the Second World War. And in the CIA absorbs some of these agents that had worked for the SS, but also recruits others. And these are, it's very difficult to trace what the CIA personnel thought because, you know, their documents are usually secret, but we can indirectly infer from people that we can reasonably assume worked for the CIA or at least were informants or were associated with the CIA, what they thought. And really prominent here was a gentleman named Kenneth Pandar. He was the leading OSS agent during the war. He leaves the army after the war, and he begins to establish a bottling plant in Casablanca that bottles Coca-Cola for the American market, for the Moroccan market, and then later on, it's also used to ship bottles to France. And he is personally very sympathetic to the nationalists. Several Moroccan nationalists sit on the board of his company. When Abdelkhadir Torres, he's exiled for a period of time from Spanish Morocco to Tangier. And I think it's in 51, he's allowed to return to Tetouan. They have a big celebration. Hizb al-Islah has a big celebration. And Coca-Cola sponsored several cradles of Coca-Cola bottles. Coca-Cola becomes the main advertiser in Al-Alam, the most important nationalist newspaper, thus underlining its close connection to the nationalists. Members of the royal family are seen in public drinking Coca-Cola. They also invest in Kenneth Pandar's company. So there's a very close link. Now, we cannot definitively prove that Kenneth Pandar was a CIA agent at that time. And perhaps he wasn't. But what seems very plausible is that his close connection and his lobbying on behalf of the Moroccan nationalists whenever he met American diplomats in Paris, in Morocco, and also in Washington, D.C., indicates that he was much more than just an engaged private citizen. And another thing to consider is that in these early stages of the construction of the intelligence community in the United States, and to a certain degree that holds still today, it isn't necessarily a binary, right? You're not necessarily working for the CIA. You're like an agent that is registered, or you're not. But it could be that, you know, he knew people that worked for the CIA, right? People he knew from school, people from his previous work. You know, he was a patriot. So there was definitely some relationship, whether he was on the payroll, it was just sort of something informal. And he was not the official spokesman for the CIA either. But it underlines the role that some American businessmen, that all of whom used to work for the security apparatus in the United States, or maybe still were sympathetic to the Moroccans and offered some help here and there. And I can go into more details later on if you're interested. And that is sort of the other arm. But and you also see it on the higher levels of the CIA, where officials are much more sympathetic towards the demands of anti-colonial nationalist movements in the Arab world and elsewhere than the State Department. And the logic amongst the CIA chiefs is that if we do not help these anti-colonial movements, ultimately the whole region will descend into chaos, and that is more detrimental to our national security than just pushing the French out. So it's different visions for US foreign policy and the emerging US empire after the war. And then finally, the final agents are, of course, the White House. So there's the Truman administration. Truman comes into power with the death of FDR, of President Roosevelt in 1945. And he has a much more conservative take. He really establishes the, to a certain degree, his push to do it, but he also willingly establishes this rivalry with the Soviet Union. He's not interested in detente. And he really is, his administration is much closer on the side of the State Department in thinking that ultimately loyalty to France supersedes everything else in North Africa. Then with the arrival of the Eisenhower administration, President Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1953, this skepticism towards anti-colonial nationalist movements continues. And the Eisenhower administration is largely supportive of France until the very end, except that because of the increasing international public pressure, they do behind the stage begin to pressure France in return to grant some autonomy, to maybe start thinking about independence. So there are things happening, but there isn't an enthusiastic support of a Moroccan independence until it is an actual until it has actually been achieved.
Well, let's talk about Moroccans who went to the United States. So there, in your book, you talk about, you highlight New York City as kind of a central hub for nationalist activity because of the location of the United Nations there. But which Moroccans are going to New York, and you know, what are they finding there?
Right, so the first attempt at lobbying is in 1947. Mehdi Benouna, member of Hizb al-Islah al-Watani, the Party of National Reform. He's a member of the, you know, elites of Tetuani society. He has studied in Cairo. He knows all the most important nationalists from the French zone. Like I said, they were all friends, they were all connected. And he travels to New York, sent by both the Party of National Reform and the Istiqlal on behalf of both, and with the unofficial blessing of Mohammed Ben Youssef, to lobby at the newly established United Nations. The UN didn't have its headquarters, the one that we all know in Manhattan yet. So it was actually a temporary building in Flushing, Queens, and in Lake Success on Long Island. And he goes there and basically tries to be a one-man diplomatic corps, lobbying the diplomats, the politicians, and also the journalists gathered there on behalf of Moroccan independence. And he stays for exactly 6 months. He does his, you know, really best, and it's very astonishing how during the early years of the UN, these protocols of international diplomacy, of basic access, were established, right? He just comes from Morocco, and the American legation in Tangier had given him paperwork to travel to the United States. It's not entirely clear why he got those. The French were infuriated, but there he was. And he was quite successful at literally meeting every prominent diplomat, at getting his message out. The New York Times reports about him, Washington Post reports about him, right? He gets invited to speak at churches, at women's clubs to bring out the message of the Moroccan nationalist movement. He's very close to the diplomats of the Arab League. It's a very complicated relationship to them because on the one hand, you know, they help him to a certain degree, but they're not really interested in the case of Morocco because 1947, that's the political struggle over the future of Palestine. And we all know that in November 47, the United Nations votes to partition Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. And sort of the focus of the Arab diplomats there is on preventing that from happening. And a Moroccan that might distract from this effort, you know, everybody technically supports him, but not really. But nonetheless, he gains this valuable experience. And then just the experience of coming to the United States itself is really fascinating. He wrote a diary. It's very detailed, in which he really, you know, writes, unsurprisingly, on a daily basis, his impressions. And to sum it up, he really likes the United States. He's fascinated by New York, by how many people there live. He once said that one building in New York contains probably more people than the entire city of Tetuan, right? This like hecticness, the rush, the multiple languages that are being spoken. At the same time, it's very disorienting. After the 7 or 8 weeks there, he's completely exhausted. I mean, he works hard, but it's also just very draining to be in New York. And remember, Benouna had lived in Cairo for many years, which to anybody who has been in Cairo is a very hectic and energy-sucking city to be in, and yet he still felt New York was a very overwhelming place. He liked the Americans. They were really friendly to him. They're very open-minded. They were so interested in him. They're interested in the case of Morocco. He also perceived him to be extraordinarily ignorant of the world. They knew virtually nothing about anything beyond American borders, which was a little bit irritating, but at the same time, they made up for that through their genuine interest in learning about the world. The rabid anti-communism of the second Red Scare during this period is something he notices, right? It's like, we gotta make sure we're not associated with any communists, which isn't very difficult because the leaders of the Istiqlal are all members of the upper bourgeoisie, right? These are men of wealth. They're not prone to radical left-wing ideas of, you know, resource redistribution within a society. But ultimately, it's a very positive idea. He comes back and the nationalist leadership wants to know, so how did it go, right? Like, what's your conclusion? He said, well, it was too early. Diplomacy wasn't ready yet. The Americans are ready for us, but we need to invest more resources. We got to send more men there. And most importantly, we need people that are our brokers, people that can act on our behalf, that speak on our behalf, that really understand the way that Anglo people or Americans work. And so in 1952, the Istiqlal officially establishes the Moroccan Office of Information and Documentation run by Dr. Mehdi Ben Aboud from SNE and Mohamed Larzawi, the big Moroccan anti-colonial capitalist who migrates there partially for patriotic but mainly for business reasons. And then eventually other members of the nationalist movement go there, and they operate out of this office first in Manhattan, just a few blocks away from the new UN headquarters in Manhattan. And they lobby, they print publications, like regular publications like Free Morocco, Moroccan News Bulletin. Rom Landau is their mentor. He edits the publications. He writes a book called The Sultan of Morocco, which is basically a hagiography of the Sultan, which is disseminated as propaganda material. And they managed to continuously enter the building, the UN building, because all the Moroccan nationalists get individual diplomatic passports from different Muslim states, right? One is made a Pakistani diplomat, one is made an Indonesian diplomat, one is made a Syrian diplomat. So they can all enter and lobby there on their behalf. And ultimately, they are quite good at doing so. They get major support from public figures like Eleanor Roosevelt, one of the most prominent American public figures by a Supreme Court judge, William O. Douglas. He speaks out in favor of Moroccan independence. He blasts French Morocco as a what he calls a police state. And there's a genuine, there's a lot of media coverage, and they do an excellent job. And the French, if you look at the records of the French diplomats stationed in New York, it's not their only issue on their mind, but it is more than just a nuisance. They are obsessed with it, and they're just thinking about what can we do to stop these Moroccans smearing our project, undermining our standing. Because ultimately, real political power rests with them. The Moroccans are not really influential to, they're not able to make the United Nations sort of force France to leave Morocco. That would have, you know, would have also been impossible, I would argue. But they really, really annoy the French, and they do create this massive international pressure. And just one final note, Spain is not part of the United Nations because Franco's regime, because of its close relationship to Nazi Germany, is basically isolated on the global stage. It may not join the UN until eventually makes a deal with the Eisenhower administration in 1955, but that's not there yet. And so there isn't really any effort to delegitimize Spain because it's also already is kind of delegitimized. Plus, the Treaty of Fez of 1912 granted France the right to establish a protectorate. Then France signed a separate agreement with Spain, granting northern Morocco to Spain as sort of a sublease. Basically, the French just wanted the Spaniards to stop annoying them, and they gave them a part, and they just said, hopefully you're happy. So the Moroccans understood correctly that if France is forced or is just relinquishes its protectorate, the Spanish protectorate will automatically fall right after that. And that's why their efforts, even by those that came from Spanish Morocco, were mainly against France, and they didn't really find it necessary to talk about Spain at the United Nations.
I mean, you opened up a couple different really interesting questions there. I mean, I want to go back and just ask the nerdy historian question. This diary of Benouna, I mean, you've made the connection elsewhere in your scholarship to Rihla literature, specifically Mohammed Asafar and his journey to France in 1845 and 1846, writing a kind of travelogue about that excursion. First, I want to know where you found the Benouna files, the Benouna diary, and sort of what it's like kind of going through the story of his trip to his trip to New York. That's my first question.
All right. So first, before we begin, for those interested in how Arabs perceived the United States during the first half of the 20th century, roughly, there's a great book called America in an Arab Mirror that was published by Palgrave in 2011. And it's just a collection of translations of testimonies, diaries, reports written by Arabs that traveled to the United States, often New York, but not only. None of them are Moroccans. They're all from Syria, Iraq, and Egypt. And they share their impression favorably, unfavorably. And it's a really interesting historical document on sort of the early stages, or like on an individual level, the perception that Arabs had coming to the United States. Sort of, I view Mehdi Benouna's diary to fit into this genre. Now, it's not in this book. I uncovered it in the villa of Boubkar Benouna, scion of the very prominent Benouna family in Tetouan. And he very generously granted me access to his family archive. He really spent a lot of time organizing the files that, you know, of the nationalist movement that came through his two brothers, mainly, Mehdi Benouna and Tayyip Benouna, both of whom were, of course, very prominent individuals in post-independence Morocco. So I got access to all of the records and a huge amount of photos, and amongst other things, this diary that Benouna wrote. And it's really one of those great finds a historian can have. I mean, I found a lot of great documents, but that was really amazing. It first of all, Mehdi Benouna has perfect handwriting, which for non-Arab speaking historian is a great gift. By contrast, I have the personal letters of Abdelkhalik Torres, and even my Moroccan colleagues and friends can barely decipher what in the world he's writing. It's really, it's brutal slog and not very rewarding to work through it, right? So first of all, the level of just clarity, it's beautiful just for the historian. And then it is really great because it operates on the two levels a historian wishes all sort of sources do, actually maybe even more levels, right? On the one hand, it talks about the diplomatic outreach efforts, the publicity campaign. You know, I met the king of Saudi Arabia. I met the ambassador of Mexico. I met so-and-so, so-and-so. And then it's summarizing everything they have talked about, right? It's a unique testimony about not only Moroccan nationalism, but just international diplomacy in the early United Nations. It's very fascinating. But at the same time, Benouna really engages in self-reflection, right? He writes a lot about his perceptions of American society and what he thought about them. And for example, just an example and paraphrasing here, right? One day he notices that when a mailbox is overflowing in New York, people just place their packages and their mail outside the mailbox on the floor. And he's absolutely shocked because his conclusion is Americans must be such an honest people, they would never steal mail, which I can hardly imagine anybody doing this in the 21st century United States. But, you know, that sort of impresses him. It's like very organized and honest people. And then I don't think he witnesses it personally. It doesn't really become clear or if he reads about it, sort of ambiguous in the text. But there's a case where a robber runs away from the police in the middle of Manhattan, full traffic, and the police just opens fire and just shoots him, which, you know, to him is absolutely shocking. Say what you will about the, you know, pretty brutal and repressive police state that the French were running in North Africa, but the default of the average French police officer was not to open fire on somebody who was fleeing them, right? And he's just shot in the middle of traffic, in the middle of pedestrians who could have all been killed. And he's just like, this is his image sort of America, right? These like extreme contradictions. And then again, to go back to the book I mentioned earlier, that is something that runs through all of these texts. This fascinating, like certain like American openness and friendliness and what they perceive to be extreme honesty is really something that struck Benouna, but also many other travelers. At the same time, virtually every Arab who comes to the United States during this period is shocked by what they perceive to be American obsession with violence, right? Violent sports, wow. Violent police, and that this is part of American culture. And then this extremely hectic and fast-paced life, which on the one hand, is perceived to be, especially in big cities like New York, right? It's perceived to be, you know, very modern and invigorating, but also, you know, Benouna himself doesn't put it that way, but he implies it several times. Other travelers like Syed Qutb from Egypt are much more explicit in just saying, Americans are just super materialist. They don't have any spiritual values of any kind. All they think about is make money and acquire material goods. So he's not as critical, but this perception that is a central sort of part of American culture is important to him as well. And so, yeah, overall, I think it's a really great a source, a great insight into how it's not representative of all Moroccans. It is an educated, wealthy gentleman who had lived abroad, right? He speaks Spanish, he speaks some French, he lived in Cairo, right? He's not very representative of all Moroccans, but nonetheless, I would say it is very interesting to gain this very personal insight into their perceptions of America, of themselves, given that we do not always have many sources about colonial Morocco in which Moroccans themselves speak about their own experiences in such great detail.
The last question I want to ask you is, I guess, just about the legacy. I mean, if you kind of take the nationalist movement, the independence movement, these episodes,
You know, how do you see them in this kind of 250-year scope of Moroccan-American relations?
Right. Oh, there's a lot of, that's a really broad question. It's a very good one. I'm going to try to keep it sort of focused, right? So on the one hand, of course, this legacy of, you know, Morocco recognizing the United States and this being it's one of the first or the first foreign country, right, is until today part of Moroccan, you know, self-identity, but also public relations, right? It's like, you know, I'm pretty sure if you click on the homepage of the Moroccan embassy in Washington, D.C., it's immediately like listed there. It fits into the, like, you don't want to draw a direct historical arc from there to this campaign, right? It's just, there's no direct connection. It's just in that connection in our minds, because we look at for American Moroccan relations, so we like try to draw a line, but there isn't a direct thing. Having said that, the way that the Moroccans managed to influence public opinion in the United States, the relatively positive reception they had here meant that these people who were in the United States to lobby on behalf of independence, they go back to Morocco and they are part of the state elite, right? Mehdi Benouna founds Maghreb Agence Presse, I think it's called, the first independent news agency in Morocco. Dr. Mehdi Ben Aboud, who ran the MOID in New York, he becomes the first Moroccan ambassador to Washington. And then many of these other individuals work for the State Department. Mehdi Benouna works as a press secretary for the Royal Palace. So they're all really part, these key players in this nascent, independent Moroccan state. And I would argue that is one of these very positive personal relationships really contribute to the fact that Morocco becomes very close to the United States after independence.
Really interesting. David, thank you so much for the historical perspective, for bringing this side of the Moroccan independence story to the forefront and talking to us just about the U.S. connection there.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Moroccan American. This podcast was recorded and produced by Graham Cornwell, that's me, and Amanda Brockler. The podcast intro and outro music is Coast Highway by AA Alto. Moroccan American is part of the Moroccan American Studies Initiative. Thanks to the Institute for Middle East Studies at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. And finally, a big thank you to the Tangier American Legation, Institute for Moroccan Studies, and the U.S. Embassy at Rabat, whose support makes this project possible. Of course, the words and ideas expressed in this podcast series do not represent either of our sponsors.